Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Kaneko Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a panel discussion entitled Undivided Lives, a conversation about career and creativity. The moderator will be Roger Fransecki, psychologist, writer, and chief executive officer of the Apogee Group, a global management, consulting, and leadership development organization founded in 1995. The members of the panel will be publisher of the Buffalo News, founder of the Omaha Sun newspapers, artist and photographer Stanford Lipsy, online media specialist, artist and photographer Molly Jarbo, TD Ameritrade stockbroker and sculptor Tom Kaminsky, and University of Nebraska Medical Center scientist and researcher, songwriter and poet James Salhaney. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday evening, April 29, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of Kaneko, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Kaneko Executive Director Hal France.
Tonight's program was an idea inspired by the artist of the exhibit that surrounds us, Stanford Lipsy, and the brilliant example of his life as a newspaper publisher and as an art photographer. We wanted to explore the ways people manage and develop their careers and their creative passions. We have a great panel tonight, so we hope you have a great time. And I know I'm not going to be the last one that's going to ask you to all feel like you can participate in this evening, because tonight's subject is something that really affects many of us. And we'd love to hear what your thoughts are about this. Last year at the Big Omaha Conference, I had the pleasure of hearing one of the opening speakers. The Big Omaha Conference for Entrepreneurs happens here at Kaneko. It'll be its third year in May. It's a marvelous conference that's produced by the staff of Silicon Prairie News. And they do a great job of bringing in national speakers and entrepreneurs, very successful people, tremendous energy, and leading the parade of great speakers was the man who is going to join me shortly. When I heard him speak, I said, we got to get to know this guy. He has a wonderful energy. He's done a lot in his time here in Omaha, but his career is much bigger than that. He is a psychologist and a writer and the founder of the Apogee Group, a global management consulting organization which was founded in 1995. He serves as a clinical professor of leadership at Creighton University College of Business. His work with leaders of many organizations evolved from more than four decades as a corporate executive, organizational consultant, clinical psychologist, and university professor. And he is regarded as one of the nation's leading executive coaches and CEO advisors. He also is kind of a spark plug and a catalyst, and that's why we wanted to have him come up here tonight, because he's going to lead our panel and join me right now as we discuss tonight's program. Please welcome Roger Fransecki.
Good evening. Surely we should sing or something if we're standing up here together. That would
I didn't
be
mean
a
to turn my back
terrifying.
On you.
Yeah, I saw you do that.
Yes,
that
I know.
That was rude, but you'll be forgiven.
I thought you were going to ask me to sing. That's really the problem.
Well, actually, the idea for this program, which I thought was brilliant, was the basis of the seduction sitting in a restaurant in Dundee that you performed with great skill, saying, here's a topic that I think would be on the money for a lot of people who live divided lives, who have profound aspirations, who want their work in their life to be more aligned, and the art of their life to be more visible to themselves and others. So what could we do? And you came up with a bunch of strange titles, which I love.
I know. We went through them. They all sounded good at the time. The first one was Double Lives, but as we started to think about it, espionage and schizophrenia started to come into.
Cross-dressing came to mind. That wasn't the idea.
So we dumped Double Lives. And then we had Divided Lives, which is kind of not where we landed, and it kind of sounded a little sad.
That's right.
So we ended up with Undivided Lives, which is somewhere where we decided we better stop.
Well, I think a more serious point is that so many of the people that I know have as clients and friends and colleagues across the globe are all folks who are all in their own ways profoundly remarkable, but have voices that they want to realize outside the work they're doing or beyond the horizons that people see them performing within. And so the notion of undivided lives is to me an invitation to look at what I think is the prose and poetry of life. Most of us live in the prose. It's the work. It's the competencies we have to perform. It's what we're paid to do. We lead prose lives. But life really comes alive and is ignited and has meaning when it has poetry, when we can begin to experience the small and large spaces of connection. We can be more empathetic and more intuitive. We can step in with enlarged retinas as you look around this room and begin to see life and see relationships as being deeper and more provocative and more inviting. And that's to me is what an undivided life is. And I think it's very hard. Linda Stone at Microsoft said, we live in an age of continuous partial attention. We're never really there. All the devices that are buzzing in your laptops now and in your pockets, all the things that take us away from being present in our own life make our life even more divided. So our hope tonight, you're going to hear from four remarkable people, but our hope tonight, as Hal said, is this is a conversation. And so when we finish hearing from them, my job is to provoke you to ask questions and to probe, because I think it's not just a night to watch and scratch and sniff. It's really a life and an invitation to say, what does this mean for me? How does my work become more visible? How do I witness what I am and what I'm becoming in my work so that there's an alignment? And I think you get to a stage of life, certainly I've been there for a while, where you're trying to make your work count for something more than a transaction. And you're trying to make your life have meaning. And the people you're going to hear from tonight are doing that. They're doing it in stone. They're doing it in poetry. They're doing it in music. They're doing it in prose. But they've all found a voice for what is coming out of them. And I would argue every one of you here has that music. Every one of you here has that inclination. And tonight I hope we can give ourselves permission to at least talk about that. We have some inspiring mentors and folks who are here, and my job and Hal's job is to kind of move the conversation from thinking to action, thinking to introspection, take a risk. So that's what we're here to do in undivided lives, right?
Well said. I don't know if anyone have picked up on this, undivided lives, very divided stage. We have this gulf in between. It's just a technical thing. We're eventually going to fill in
Indeed
and be all
are.
Together as an undivided group. It's now my pleasure to introduce to you our four panelists. They're all going to come up individually. And part of our idea about tonight was to let each one of them tell you a little bit about how they manage and develop their careers and their creative passions. And they're all very different, as we all are. And this is what a place like Kaneko is really trying to get at. There's no limit to how our individuality should influence the way we live. Tom Kaminsky is a TD Ameritrade stockbroker and he has a full-time sculpture studio. He's the youngest member of our panel. He's from LaPorte, Indiana. He graduated Creighton in marketing and finance with a Bachelor of Science, and he's working on a Bachelor of Arts in studio art. His website says something that I think was clever and I wanted to share with you. It's the roots of the name Kaminsky in Polish. From the root kamien, meaning stone or rock, this very common Polish surname means one who came from a rocky place, or sometimes a person who works with rock, such as a stone carver. Usually the name indicates that the person originally came from any one of a dozen Polish villages named Kamien, meaning rocky place. Well, I think it's a wonderful thing to put on the website for a sculpture studio. Please welcome Tom Kaminsky. Hey, Tom. Our next panelist is an Omaha native. Her duality has been being an online media specialist and an art photographer. Molly Jarbo has degrees from Kansas City Art Institute and the University of Buffalo. She has established her studio in Buffalo, New York, where she now lives, and she has worked as an online media specialist for the Buffalo News. She's at a transition point right now, and she recently embarked on a new venture of starting a commercial photography studio. You will be delighted if you visit her website, and I encourage you to, because it's a beautiful, imaginative, and delightful website, which suits the personality of the person you're about to meet. She indeed is all of those things. She wrote me about coming and talking tonight to say she has a passion for maintaining a balanced and creative life as a professional and as an artist. Finding a way to do what we really want to do in life is what it's all about, and there are many stepping stones along the way. Please welcome Molly Jarbo. Our next guest has the kind of resume that makes me realize that, you know, becoming a musician wasn't all that big of a deal. This guy is both a musician, a poet, but when I read his science credentials, which makes him a first-class medical researcher at our wonderful UNMC, you'll be very impressed. He has a Bachelor of Science degree in chemistry from the University of Florida, which he got in 1972. In 1974, he received his PhD from the University of Chicago in biophysics. His thesis work started at the Bell Labs in Murray Hill, New Jersey, and continued there, where he did postdoctoral research on in vivo magnetic resonance of living cells at the same institution, working with Robert Shulman and Seiji Ogawa. He's been at UNMC for 35 years, working on in vivo magnetic resonance of perfused hearts, on blood cell membranes, and on AIDS antivirals. He's published 96 papers in peer-reviewed journals and one book on red blood cells. He is an avid songwriter, poet, and record producer with over 53 copyrighted songs. Together with his wife, Christine Salhaney, he has produced 8 CDs. Please welcome James Salhaney. And the reason we're here tonight is the example of Stanford Lipsey. Born in Omaha, a graduate of Central High, he began his career in newspapers as a photojournalist for the Central High Register. He rose to become owner and publisher of the Sun newspapers in Omaha, which he sold to Warren Buffett in 1969, staying on as publisher. He was the first Berkshire Hathaway manager. In 1973, Warren, Stan, and Paul Williams won the Pulitzer Prize for their financial expose of Boys Town, the same year that Woodward and Bernstein won the Pulitzer for public service for their little story that they did. In 1983, he became the publisher of the Buffalo News and Daily News. All that time leading to today, where he still is the publisher of the Buffalo News, over almost 50 years as publisher of newspapers, he got his camera when he was 10. It never left his side. His love and pursuit of photography has been with him every step of the way. This is Stan Lipsey's 13th show and the largest one to date. We hope you'll stay and enjoy this beautiful exhibit. And now please welcome Stanford Lipsey. Roger, do you have anything you would like to say before I leave the stage?
I don't think you should ever leave the stage. We would really like you just to stay where you are. You're a spellbinder. He is, actually. He is.
Thanks.
And he's a lot of fun. He's also, and this is a very dangerous stage, as you've noticed. We are.
Yes, did
down.
Everyone see that?
That's right.
Okay.
No.
Don't do it that way.
He's been practicing a forward roll for an hour, waiting for the opportunity to do this. Well, this is a sort of intimidating crowd. out there and an intimidating crowd here. But now it's time to get a little glimpse of what their undivided lives have produced. And so we're going to turn to the first of our folks. Tom, aren't you first?
Yeah.
Well, we would like you to share with you what you wish. Thank you. Want to get a sense of what you've been doing back there.
Okay, that's a slightly hairier version of my current self in my studio. My name is Tom Kaminsky. Graduated in 2007 from Creighton University with a BSBA Marketing and Finance. And interesting thing happened during my senior year at Creighton. I took a sculpture course. I'd always been interested in painting and drawing, but never really truly connected with a medium until I took sculpture, a simple clay modeling course. And I immediately knew in my second semester, weeks from graduation, that I had found what I really wanted to do with a lot of my time. So I had already been offered a job with TD Ameritrade to work for them. And so I took that position and set up a small studio in my apartment. And so the question became, right off the bat, how do I make this work? How do I get this to be a more important part of my life? And so besides my studio, I started with doing some figurative sculpture, a few clay busts. I re-enrolled at Creighton to start pursuing a BA of art. And to make it really work, I needed some flexibility. I didn't want to leave my career, but I wasn't ready to dive completely into sculpture. So I started working full-time, 3 days a week, 13-hour days, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. 14 hours. I'd try to knock out all 40 in 3 days. Then I spent the rest of the time in my studio or in a studio I have on Creighton's campus working on sculpture. Started with figurative work. Then I transitioned into, I started looking more at space and form. And from there, it was strange. I felt the same, I was really compelled to sculpt. And I felt the same feelings toward stone carving. Just from the moment I picked up my first stone, there was a strange connection with it. And immediately, this is about a year ago, just started committing my time to carving stone. And so I spend 8 to 10 hours a day, most days, Monday through Thursday, chipping away at these little pebbles by myself. And it's interesting, the connections between finding, I mean, helping someone select a mutual fund is not a lot like chipping away at a stone, believe it or not. But it's just a different way of sorting through conflict, I think. You start with, in finance, a clearly identifiable problem and a finite number of solutions. And you work with another individual and you work toward a solution. Whereas when I step into the studio, it's not really like that. The conflict is, how can I continue this dialogue with myself? How will my next piece speak to what I've done in the past or speak to where I'm going with the next step? It's just kind of a different way of approaching conflict. And so I balance. I try to bring these lives together. I follow the market when I'm in the studio. Unfortunately, every now and then I peek. I try not to. And then I always have a sketchbook within reach at my desk. And that's kind of how I bridge the gap. A lot of my great ideas are, for whatever reason, born after my morning coffee at the office between like 8 and 10 a.m. So, the key thing for me to make this divided / undivided life work was just, for me, it was time, making time work. So it's not like other elements of art where you can kind of, I'm not going to walk out to my car and chip at a stone for 20 minutes on my lunch break at the office. So you need time. And so this was my way of resolving that, bringing it all together. So that's my story.
It's only the beginning of your story.
Yeah,
we're going to hear more.
Starting.
The notion that your broker is somehow doing this in the background is disconcerting, but he does it brilliantly. That's a glorious example of multitasking, but with a real constant 24/7 mind, constantly sweeping, paying attention. I heard him say the other night he keeps a notebook, and the notebook is full of stuff all the time, so it's a constant transition. We know a lot about transitions in the science of adult change, and one of the things we know is that transitions begin with endings, not beginnings. And Molly has been at an interesting ending, finishing one part of a career and starting anew. We're going to hear about that. Molly?
First of all, thank you, Hal, for inviting me to be a part of this really great conversation. And I also want to say that I'm very, very pleased to be back in Omaha, and this is where my path to find balance in my creative life began. I have a confession that I want to start off with, and that is that I don't always feel undivided. Sometimes, in fact, I feel very divided. And one of the things that I do to try to deal with that and to find balance is I envision myself on a path, and all along the way there are stepping stones. And sometimes I make it my way along that path with great purpose and intention, and sometimes I stumble and look and search for a sign and hope that somehow I'll get some direction. But I think that that's part of finding an undivided life, and it's crucial because sometimes we really do need to stop and think about what we're doing and sometimes completely regroup and go in a different direction altogether. I'll start by talking about where it all began here in Omaha, Nebraska. Both of my parents were artists, very passionate hobbyists, and they always encouraged my sisters and I to pursue the arts. So I had a really great start there. And we had the Joslin Art Museum, which was a great resource and something that I will always remember in the backdrop of my childhood. The next stepping stone that I think is significant is the time that I spent at Central High School, which was a fantastic old building and very inspiring for somebody who is into visual arts. And there was also the Career Center, which is a great program that OPS offers, and it encourages students to pursue their interests in various career-related endeavors and directions. Next was the Kansas City Art Institute. When I went to the Kansas City Art Institute, I had already begun looking at a lot of the old boys in documentary photography. One of my biggest inspirations was Robert Frank, for example. And so I really tried to emulate that by photographing documenting underprivileged people living on the edge. But the next stepping stone in my creative process came when I went to graduate school in Buffalo, and that's what brought me to Buffalo at UB. And I started reading more about making images and representation, and I was looking at authors like Abigail Solomon Godot and Martha Rosler, for example, who wrote about what it means to document underprivileged people and bring them into a gallery and display images of them. And I really wanted to examine new ways of approaching the same subject without exploiting individuals. So I started photographing objects that represented individuals. From there, many conversations with other artists challenged the work that I was doing and made me start asking questions like truth in photography and what does it mean if these images are set up or if they're actual real documents, and do the images have the same meaning if I've set them up or if I've actually found them and documented them. And that made me curious about taking another path and going into a documentary style of photography where I'm actually being much more involved in the end result of the objects and images that I'm photographing. So I started setting images up and creating a more dreamlike scenario of images that are documented in toys is where I started. So now with this series called If I Die Before I Wake, Things I May Have Lost, I'm actually photographing little toys that I've set up. And finally, to my current work, now I'm actually going back to where I started along the way and quoting some of the documentary work, but I'm setting everything up. And in some cases, the images are actually digitally altered. I'd like to just tell you a little bit about this project. Instead of photographing people. I started photographing the spaces and places where they live. And my work has evolved into a combining of traditional documentary and landscape with scenes that I set up or recontextualize and even digitally alter. I've begun tapping into one of the things that fascinated me about art when I was a little kid. Imagination and dreams, and also remembering, are a big part of what I try to conjure with my new creative work. And along the path that I've taken to get where I am, what's been most important is trying to keep that creativity alive. And the work that I am currently doing and the path that I'm on now of commercial photography is something that is yet another stepping stone and allows me to have balance with the work that I want to do with art and the work that helps me pay the bills and buy the equipment and frame the artwork to show in galleries. Thank you.
What's always breathtaking and inspiring is to see how people see their world. Isn't it amazing how we all, there's a viewfinder that surrounds our experience, and it's that whole notion that some of us barely look, to say nothing of staring. And a photographer frames the world in a way that is provocative and inviting and beguiling in its own way. Look around you. I mean, the whole notion that photography implies and invites our, I think, passive visual literacy, our curiosity about what we see, and gives it a frame. And you've certainly, I thought the pictures with the toys were particularly provocative. It's really something. Well, Jim is sort of a slouch. We're desperately trying something that he can do well. You know, really, if you visit where he lives, it's rather breathtaking in its own way, but then he takes you into his studio, which is unbelievable, and you get a sense that you really lead a really dumb, simple life. You know, you go to the grocery store, you fill your car up, and you make telephone calls and hope people call back. Both he and his wife are just amazing, and you're about to hear that. And there's a lot for him to share. So with that, Jim.
Thank you. Well, I want to thank you for inviting me, Hal, and the reason is I feel like I'm not alone. I can tell you, I can't tell you how many times people ask me, how can you be a scientist and a musician? How can you write papers and songs? And my answer to them is always, well, I don't play golf, and I don't sleep that much. And I think there's another one, too, which is I don't have a television. So. And when you get older, you sleep a lot less, I think. So where did it all start? That's one of the things that we've been discussing. And for me, I came from a family of, my dad was a butcher for Kroger, and my mother was high school educated in the 30s, cashier for A&P, the Great Atlantic Pacific Tea Company, which I don't know is that great anymore. But anyway, so we watched a lot of television, and that really wasn't that, I mean, I liked Howdy Doody and all those guys, but what really happened to me was we moved from the inner city of Detroit to the suburb of Livonia, which is a Russian name. And the schools there were fantastic, and I got the bug of learning. But what really kicked it off was, besides my ninth grade science teacher, biology teacher, who was fantastic, was the Russians. They sent a rocket up into the space called Sputnik. And I can tell you what happened. All the old books went out, and these new typewritten manuals came in, and you had to be totally dead not to want to go into science. And that's what happened to me. Then I ended up at Wayne State University in Detroit and began to realize there is more to life than science. I began to broaden my ideas and started taking the humanities, especially things like literature for drama for literature, and poetry. And poetry is what really got the interest to me, because at that time, W.D. Snodgrass was there and creating a new direction in poetry, something he used to call in his own voice. I think he even has a book to that title. And he won the Pulitzer Prize for his book, although if you look at him on YouTube, he will say that it was a mistake. But, you know, who knows. I loved this stuff, and I loved the freedom that was offered by that, and I started doing some writing then. And the interesting thing that caught my mind at that time is that morphing from science to poetry really wasn't all that different. I mean, I write in science. You can't get too verbose there because there are a lot of people in foreign countries who English is not their first language, so you have to be careful of not getting, you know, T.S. Eliot on them. The other thing is discovering commonalities. And I have found some that are very interesting, and more recently I've been trying to incorporate them into my songs, not to explain the science, but to use it as a sort of paint, if you will. And Chris and I just put out a CD last year, 209, called Time's Arrow. And Time's Arrow is a cosmological concept which has to do with time being asymmetrical, always going forward due to the second law of thermodynamics. I don't want to get too involved here, but and you know, it always sort of a time cone kind of thing. In this song that I think best represents the use of science in poetry and art, I was inspired to write a poem that was published by Fine Lines here in Omaha. And it the object of the poem is to talk about a genetic diversity and how you can get to a dead end if you're not careful. And, of course, this is, I think, rather profound implications, that subject, that is, in that people are doing a lot of things, and, you know, the perfect potato that McDonald's wants could be the end of the potato. And we have to be careful about this. So I thought, you know, it'd be kind of a cool thing to write about. So I always loved roses, and bees are part of roses and other flowering plants, of course. And so I wrote this poem called The Wilted Rose, and it's about this process of he talks about the first rose, the prehistoric rose, which if you ever see an example of that, is pretty bizarre looking. And the rose that has ended up being the rose of the human dream, which has nothing to do with the first rose except that it was its ancestor, and we have manipulated it since. So in this poem, I talk about that, and I talk about the bee as the abstruse bee, that bee you can't understand what he's doing in the end. So let me read this, and then I'd like to have them play a song from that CD called Time's Arrow with my wife, Christine, singing, and I'm playing a bass guitar as an improvisational instrument and percussion and other things. Of how we morphed two apparently disparate fields. As I get old, you need glasses for certain things and not for others. Okay, the wilted rose. The dirt beneath my feet confounds its origins, composed of past lives and lexica, couched in the treachery of human existence. It lies as mere molecules in the sand. Yet these are passing thoughts, intoxications caused by the smell of roses in the garden of a spinning sea, where emotions arise from a passion dream of a rose given for love or the passing of time. Manifest in the content of the dream, latency is revealed between the first rose and the hybridizer's zeal, where manipulation is held in high esteem as the abstruse bee flies with such profundity, alighting between the petals of a wilted rose, forever lost in the pursuit of honey. So now the song that you're going to hear is about the bee. It's called The Abstruse Bee. And I want to say, too, that it's interesting that trying to morph a song from a poem to a song isn't easy. I've done that for several poems. I published a set of four at the University of Chicago Press in the early days. I forgot the dates even. And I recently took one of those and made it into a song on that CD. It's an interesting transition. That was really rather difficult, done to an American Indian beat. But this one is contemplative and haunting in a way. And it's about the same thing that you just heard. So you might be interested to see how the words have morphed and what ends up being now a song. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Chris, my dear wife with a great voice. I just want to close with one other thing, and that is that, you know, I have this feeling that we're here, and of course it's my own personal feeling, to take a look at this creation. We're part of it, to participate in it and to improve it where we can, but with harmony, with music. And I think it's really actually poignant that now scientists are discovering, and artists too, I should say, that our proteins are singing. In fact, you all have symphonies going on right now. For example, you can take a linear sequence and get do an algorithm with sort of a rule, get assign notes and get a song. But now they're taking the new information about how the proteins fold and the what they call tertiary interactions and adding to the symphony. And I had this thought that wouldn't it be cool if we could actually take a soundogram of you and hear you and have you hear yourself? There might be something to that. So on that note, I'll say thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, that was easy to figure out. You got that all worked out, the sound wave and the whole thing? Yeah. You got that. You figured that how to do that. You'll be tonight. You'll work that out. Whew! Isn't it wonderful how someone enters their life and finds all the different voices in some way to make their life visible, from poetry and music, from science, from W.D. Snodgrass is a favorite of mine. I haven't heard his name in a long time. It was wonderful. Somebody said, "Literature is man's illumination of man by artificial light." Literature is man's illumination of man by artificial light. That's what the arts do. They hold up the light so we can see ourselves in a way that we can't see it any other way. And you've done this in a breathtaking way. And a little bit intimidating, but breathtaking. No, really quite special. Who would have imagined? Well, 10 years ago, one of my partners, David Klein, who's one of the, I have five partners, one in the U.S., one in London. He's one of the real smart ones. Started talking about a man named Stanford Lipsey in Buffalo. Oh, okay. I moved to Omaha 8 years ago, and what I've discovered in Omaha is it isn't 3 degrees of separation. It isn't even 2 degrees of separation. It's 1 degree. And so I get an invitation from Hal to come and be part of this panel, and he said, oh, and it's all about the work of Stanford Lipsey. What's the probability of that? So the probability is a gift, and the gift you have tonight is to spend some time with this man. You see what he sees and what he shared, and you hear this interesting background of a strong editorial and business experience, cutting edge, tough, Pulitzer Prize winning, but at the same time, someone who's in that world of commerce, but from the age of 10 has had a passive and then active visual literacy to go out in the world and not only see it, but share it. So we're really very gifted tonight, and we're very fortunate to have Stanford Lipsey. Stanford.
Thank you, Roger. My creativity in photography actually stems from my creativity in work, because during the time I was working in Omaha, I was the publisher of a weekly group called the Sun Newspapers, and they were excellent papers, and we won a Pulitzer Prize, and we won a bunch of other prizes too. But the reason we won them is because we were severely handicapped, and our handicap was, as news broke, the Omaha World Herald had it immediately, and we couldn't afford to come out with the same news 5 days later. So we had to be creative, innovative. We had to find other sources and other means to publish stories that people would want to read. And there are a lot of ways to do that with other sources and follow-ups and new developments and things that we might dig up. So here I was in my work life having to do these creative things. And initially when I got into photography when I was very young, I looked at subjects in front of my lens and I saw there's a nice mountain and I'll shoot that mountain. And then I went to a workshop in Aspen one time, and the fellow that was conducting the workshop signaled me over, and he said, look at this. And he put a macro lens on his camera and showed me the very heart of a pine cone with all its magnified details. And that is one of those steps in life where you rise about whatever number of levels are necessary to entirely new dimensions. And from that time forward, I really became a interested and dedicated photographer, except for about 8 years when my kids were growing up and I was forced to take pictures of the kids. And that wiped out any creativity I had. I'm just sitting here, and I happen to be looking across the room, and there's a large obelisk of a point in the Grand Canyon. And I'm thinking, okay, what went into that? Now, I am a serious planner. I love planning. And as Judy will tell you and Molly will tell you, if I plan a trip, it's, you know, I've had about half the fun before I have to go. And they're a little alarmed when I say, I don't think I have to go. I had such a good time planning it. But this one really alarmed Judy, by the way. We didn't have a long number of time at the Grand Canyon. And I wanted to get this one obelisk who I already knew I was going to name it after a pal of mine who was the president of University of Southern California, so it's called Steve's Rock. But the question was, how I was going to find myself to that remote point in the middle of the night, because I had to get there long before dawn to set up so the morning sun would hit the various stratus of the obelisk and the entire background of the Grand Canyon would be dark. And I managed to do that. Unfortunately, I didn't come right back. And about 6 hours later, Judy had the rangers out looking for me. And that's part of the joy of my photography. A publisher operates in a very fast-paced environment where a ton of decisions are made within a space of a few minutes. And the only thing I have found that distracts me is photography. Once I go out and I'm shooting and I'm looking through the lens, I am focused entirely on where that lens is pointing. So that is one example of planning. The other extreme of planning, of course, is spontaneity. I have none. I am devoid of spontaneity. I tried spontaneity, but it just didn't blossom. So maybe in, you know, a couple years when my planning sinks. So in photography, as I said, I started out shooting straight ahead, and now it's just about the opposite. When I approach a subject, it's going to be, it can't be straight ahead. That's with exception. I mean, if the subject is so remarkable, like Calatrava's Milwaukee Art Museum, that one picture on the right, I mean, it was so magnificent, I just had to have one of that. But then it's embellished by two others that take in the scope of the wings and then the wings opening, which are just remarkable because I think those wings are 175 feet, if I'm not mistaken. The approach to a picture starts with how are you going to position yourself in an arena that's worthy or that has a good chance of presenting a scene worth photographing. Now, that's half of it. The other half, by the way, which I'm not going to spend much time on, is the macro shooting. So you may pass some inane object, but if you put a macro lens on it and multiply it, you might find things in your on your flashcard that you can't see with the human eye that are very interesting. But if you look at some of these pictures, the question I have to ask is, okay, here's a subject. The next question is, well, how many different sides of this subject am I going to shoot? And how does the light contribute to this? I think everybody knows that morning light and dusk light are the beautiful lights for photography, beautiful for anything you look at. And then the next question is, okay, do I have to be very low? So I have a device on my camera that's like the reverse of a periscope. So I can put it down and the lens will focus when I direct it on the subject. On the other hand, I have situations where I want to be quite high up, and there's a number of those, and I've had people that have been with me that are a little alarmed when I walked into somebody else's 15-story hotel room in order to get exactly the angle that I wanted, but I've not been too badly bruised. So if somebody has to have something done, Hal will tell you this, you know, if it really has to be done well, you better have Judy do it. If it has to be done quickly, along with three other things, that's where I step in. But it won't be done, you know, it might be an 80%, a 90%, it won't be 100%. Judy will be 100%. Now, another 100%er is Molly. if I'm out shooting with Molly, Molly never stops nagging me about a tripod. Put the camera on a tripod. Well, you know how awful it is to carry a tripod up a mountain? And then the jackabot run with it, you know, pulling the legs out. Don't pull the legs out. They slip out. They don't work, whatever it is. Where if I don't have a tripod, I go here. I can do whatever I want. It's wonderful. So Molly has a master's degree in fine arts. I had no training, and I probably wasn't trainable now that I think about it. I didn't take it in. I would have been a poor student. So again, actually, most of my photography now comes about as a result of saying, I want to go to this place, I've researched it, and I'm going to be able to spend 3 days there, and I'm going to get some good stuff in front of my lens. The rest of the time, I'm working real fast, I'm working real hard, I love what I'm doing, I'm finally back to, I don't write news stories, but I'm writing editorials, and I left writing 30 years ago. You become a publisher, you don't get to write. So when I get out on one of those scenes, then the question is, do I really find something? And I never get to one of those scenes that I don't find something I wasn't expecting. My associates at the Buffalo News quote me as saying, you go for popcorn and you come back with peanuts. And that pretty well describes what I might have happened to me going out on a photo shoot. So I don't know that I don't have a great deal of respect for any artistic values that I might have. I know a lot of people that are true artists. And I start out by telling you that because I think if you like art, if you admire art, that doesn't mean that you just have to be someone that views and buys art. I think you give yourself a chance. Now, I couldn't paint. People can't read my writing. I can't read my writing. I remember at Michigan, where we had two blue books in a final, I'd write the blue book, and the professor would come back and say, would you please print? And then I'd print it, and he'd come back and say, would you please write? So I do not have any artistry with my hand. It's got to be some object where I can trip a shutter, capture the moment, and I would encourage you to join me and experience your own growth in art.
I have a little sign in my office that I bought at, I think it's called Party Patch out west, and it says, if life's a stage, I want better lighting. I love that. If life's a stage, I want better lighting. You know, show me what's ahead. Well, the artist's way is the uncertain way. The artist's way is to take you into places where maybe you and he or she haven't been before. We've been very blessed today. We've had four wonderful, thoughtful, generous, articulate artists. I hope you'll join me in thanking them all. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Kaneko Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard a panel discussion entitled Undivided Lives, a conversation about career and creativity. The moderator was Roger Fransecki, psychologist, writer, and chief executive officer of the Apogee Group, a global management, consulting, and leadership development organization founded in 1995. The members of the panel were publisher of the Buffalo News, founder of the Omaha Sun Newspapers, artist and photographer Stanford Lipsy, online media specialist, artist and photographer Molly Jarbo, TD Ameritrade stockbroker and sculptor Tom Kaminsky, and University of Nebraska Medical Center scientist and researcher, songwriter, and poet James Salhaney. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday evening, April 29, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Heike Langdon, Kaneko Events and Community Relations Manager, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Special thanks also to sound engineer Rick Weiner for his assistance in the recording of this program. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.